Okay, thank you. I'm very happy to be back here. I know a lot of colleagues here. I guess some of you young bucks I don't know yet, but anyway, yeah, I sometimes joke that the page time is, well, it's supposed to be when a black hole is very old, and since I'm old, I guess they just decided to name
that.
So, anyway, so this is collaborative work that I did with these people here at a workshop that was at the Theoretical Institute at Kyoto University back last summer. And I thought I'd put the closest picture to the closest thing of a firewall. This is actually, this is a picture of a pyroclastic explosion of the Kizimin volcano on Kamchatka. Here you can see there's a big crack down the thing and sort of a pseudo firewall coming out of this crack. It was, when I snapped the picture, a 200 millimeter telephoto, I didn't even realize what it was. I thought this is a mountain with a huge overhang, and then I looked more carefully, so I realized what it was, this explosion. But it's, if you look up Kizimin, K-I-Z-I-M-E-N, in Wikipedia, then I posted my picture there, so you can see that.
What was the year?
So this was, I think this was December 10th, 2010, I think it was. Sorry, I forgot to look up on the Wikipedia article when the date was, but I
got it. No contradiction.
So, okay. So in the firewall proposal, it's assumed that the firewall lies near the event horizon and should not be observable except by infalling observers who are presumably terminated at the firewall. However, if the firewall is located near where the horizon would have been based on the space-time evolution up to that time, then later quantum fluctuations in the Hawking emission rate can cause the teleological event horizon to have migrated to the inside of the firewall location, rendering the firewall naked. So, in principle, a firewall can be arbitrarily far outside the horizon. So this casts doubt on the notion that firewalls are the, quote, most conservative solution to the information loss paradox. Okay, so that's a summary. Now let me go into a bit more of the details. Well, maybe this is kind of like bringing coals to Newcastle. Maybe it's probably dangerous for me to say, yes.
Since there isn't really a mechanism for other firewall forms, why can't you just say the firewall sort of, you know, migrates in as the event horizon does and just never appears outside?
Well, I'm making the, okay, I am making the assumption that if you have a smooth evolution of the firewall, of the horizon, that it would know to be very close to the horizon. So I mean, it's true, if you said the firewall was far inside, but I'm not sure this would solve the problems that are raised by the firewall issue if the firewall were far inside the horizon.
Just inside, but then continues to shrink.
I'm not worried about that. It's not a question, it's a question that there could be extra emission coming out that would cause the thing to shrink more, and I'm saying because the event horizon is, because it's the boundary of Scry Plus, then that event horizon would have to, the event horizon is teleological in some sense, where it is depends on the future evolution. So I mean, we'll get more details of this, but I'm saying if there's an extra, but beyond this smooth thing, an extra emission, that would mean that the event horizon would be further in than you thought it was, and it would have to be in even before this thing occurred. So if the firewall location is causal, if it depends on the causal past, it can't possibly foresee this, and therefore the event horizon could migrate inward from the thing. That's sort of the heart of the argument, and in some sense, the rest of it's just kind of amplifying this a bit more. So, okay, well, maybe, I think, okay, you all know this, and correct me if I misstated it, but they argue that local quantum field theory, unitarity, and no drama, which was the assumption that no infalling observers should not experience anything unusual at the event horizon, the black hole sufficiently large, firewall would be drama in this language, then they cannot all be consistent with each other for the Hawking evaporation of a black hole with a finite number of quantum states, say, given by the Bekenstein-Hawking entropy. So they suggested that the most conservative resolution to this inherent inconsistency is to give up no drama. So instead, an infalling observer would be terminated once he or she hits the so-called firewall. So it does seem rather surprising because the curvature is negligibly small at the event horizon of a sufficiently large black hole, at least if there's no firewalls, And it would seem like there's nothing special but low energy physics. I mean, to put it another way, it's different. If you fall into a black hole, you'll see the curvature going up. It's m over r cubed. It goes up continuously up in classically to infinity. So you know, whereas in this case, you would be sailing along with low curvature and then suddenly splat. You'd hit high curvature or high density or something. There wouldn't be a warning. You know, that's not necessarily inconsistent with the laws of physics. I mean, it would be consistent with the laws of physics if there was a shock wave coming at us at the speed of light that's going to destroy us 10 minutes from now. And if it was coming at the speed of light, we could have absolutely no warning of this. But we tend to think that that's sort of improbable. And so, you know, maybe my gut feeling is that firewalls are sort of improbable. I'm trying to raise something in the nature of a reductio ad absurdum. I can't really prove that they're absurd, but I'm trying to show that they seem to be even less conservative than had been thought. That's sort of the point of our paper. Okay, so assuming unitarity, the information contained inside a black hole should be eventually recovered from the Hawking radiation. The late time radiation purifies the earlier radiation, so the late time radiation should be maximally entangled with the earlier one. And then by the monogamy of quantum entanglement, the late time radiation cannot also be maximally entangled with the interior of the black hole. So this means the field configurations across the event horizon being not entangled, they would be oscillating, or they would be fluctuating independently, so the fields would not generically not be continuous, and that would lead to a divergent energy density, at least if the discontinuity was infinitely sharp. So in other words, the quantum field Hamiltonian contains terms like the square of the derivative and the derivative's divergence if the field configuration is not continuous, and this would be the firewall. Okay, so now usually it's thought the firewall lies at the black hole event horizon. And I'm going to, you know, assume it lies close to that, at least where the event horizon would have been if the thing evolved smoothly. In other words, if there aren't surprises happening afterwards. Now, of course, in quantum mechanics, there's no sharp boundaries, and the position of the event horizon should be uncertain, maybe to fluctuations of order the Planck length. So firewalls are presumably a bit like stretched horizons, the crucial difference that anything that hits a firewall gets incinerated instead of just passing through. I mean, old pictures of stretched horizons say from the outside it appears that there's this surface there, but if you fell in, you wouldn't see it. Okay, so by the nature of the event horizon, if the firewall lies either inside or exactly on the horizon, then it's completely invisible to the outside. So for firewalls that are not too far outside the event horizon, you still might question whether you could see it, because you might think that, well, they're deep down in this Planckian region, the local thermal atmosphere. I mean, at least if you went down there and tried to scoop some up, you'd have to have high acceleration. So you might question whether you could do that. Okay, so here we'll make the assumption the firewall, if it exists, has a location determined by the past history of the Hawking evaporating black hole spacetime, and is near where the event horizon would be if the evaporation rate were smooth without quantum fluctuations. Then we show that quantum fluctuations of the evaporation rate in the future can move the event horizon to the inside of the black firewall location, rendering it naked. And it's these future fluctuations, in some sense it's fluctuation of the negative energy influx, that cause the event horizon at the earlier time to have to shift out. I mean, it has to shift out in order that it matches after this comes in. So, okay, so the apparent horizon, okay, so for simplicity, I mean, I don't think the details depend on this, but for simplicity, we'll assume spherical symmetry, and we'll approximate the metric near the horizon of an evaporating black hole by the Vigenère metric with a negative energy influx. So this is the V is the advance time. It's the, you know, the constant V lines are like this, and they're going this way. So if we have the event horizon along here, then V increases along the events. It's that the other variable U that's some constant on the event horizon. So here's a Vigenère metric with M depending on V, and in this case, as you increase V, you're going toward the future, and the mass would be going down. So M of V is the mass of the black hole, which is decreasing as a function of the advance time V. So for a smooth evaporation rate of a spherical black hole, if it's, say, a solar mass or bigger, and if the lightest neutrino is not orders of magnitude less than the next lightest neutrino, and there are no other massless particles, then the mass emission rate, it just goes as some constant over m squared. And this was something that numerically, well, this was part of my PhD thesis that numerically evaluated. I don't trust all these digits, but I put them here. So in case somebody else calculates this, I'm curious how many I got right. If I got zero right, I'd maybe be embarrassed. I don't know if they'd take my PhD away, but anyway, whatever. Okay, so now the apparent horizon is located at R APH for apparent horizon at 2 MV. So that's the point at which outgoing null rays have are not at that moment the rate of change dr dv is zero at that rate. Now of course later the R doesn't have to stay constant, so they could either fall in or go out depending on what happens. Now the event horizon is generated by reading outgoing null GD6, so they have to stay null as you follow them. And so that in the vigeometric that obeys this equation. And the event horizon is on the boundary between the ones that go out to future null infinity, the ones that escape that go to large R, and the other side is falling into the singularity going to small R. It's believed to be believed to be inside the black hole. Well, assuming it doesn't hit a firewall. So for this smooth evaporation rate, then the event horizon is given by the solution to this, such that it does not diverge exponentially far away from the apparent horizon in the future. You look for a solution that's not exponentially going out or falling in. So then you can write a power series solution for this. So it's convenient if you define U to be 1 minus R over 2M. And notice that in this case, because there's negative energy density going in, then in this case, the apparent horizon will be outside the event horizon. So therefore, the apparent horizon's at this, the event horizon will have R less than that. So therefore, this U will be positive, be a small positive quantity. And just for, it simplifies the coefficients, if I say the mass evaporation, M dot is negative, the MdV is negative, so if I multiply by minus 4, I get a positive P. And then you can say to lowest order, U is P, but then there's these correction terms that you can get for that. And it's interesting, P is this, and you notice by this formula, then P would be 2, and so in fact this term goes away. So it's interesting that the quadratic term in P vanishes when you write it in terms of this thing, and then these are non-zero. So, okay, so now what I'm going to give some possible locations for where the firewall might be, mainly just to show that there are ways that you can define these covariantly, but my argument doesn't depend on it being any specific one of these. It really just depends upon the firewall being depending on the causal past, and if the evolution is smooth, if there weren't fluctuations up to that time, that it's where the event horizon would be. So it doesn't depend on it being close to any of these, but I'm partly showing this because, you know, sometimes there's the attitude that, well, if I want to define something locally, or actually it's quasi-locally because you have to know all the way around the whole two-sphere, but you might say, well, the apparent horizon is the only thing located quasi-locally in this spherically symmetrical thing. But of course that's not true. There's a lot of things you can define by quasi-local, and in this case, assuming spherical symmetry, it is local in the RT plane. So, okay, so for this smooth Hawking radiation, then you find, if I plug that back in to that other thing, you find that the event horizon is, the apparent horizon would have this value, it's slightly inside, and then the term that's quadratic in alpha over m squared is absent, and then so there's an order alpha cubed over. So this motivated me to just define some covariant generalization of this so that for any spherical metric I could have something that would be very close to this quantity if it were, you know, if the evaporation rate were basically m dot is minus alpha over m squared. So a covariant generalization away from the vigeometric is that you define this f dot to be the action of an outgoing null vector in alpha on f, so in alpha contracted with this, and with this outward null vector normalized so that when you apply it to the derivative of R, so R dot, in other words, in alpha R comma alpha, if you set, I mean, this is, these are identities, if you now fix in alpha so that this is equal to this. And of course, by the definition of EM in the metric, this quantity is that. I mean, the EM, the Misner-Sharp mass, just obeys that equation. So now if you define that way, if you note that if you did have this evolution for EM, this implies that EM cubed, that the second derivative of that is zero. So in other words, EM cubed is changing linearly with V. The lifetime goes as M cubed, and basically M cubed goes down linearly. And then the event horizon, as an approximation for that, the event horizon is close to this. So you could have, so this would be approximately true at the event horizon if M dot was minus alpha over M squared. So I just proposed defining something that we could call an adiabatic horizon by saying that it's the outer root of this quantity equal to zero. And this means derivatives respect, I mean, in alphas, this is what I mean by dv. And so if setting that equal to zero and taking the outer root, that would give an approximation for where the event horizon would be. So let's see, you look puzzled.
Yeah, I'm afraid I am. So this null vector n, is that defined everywhere in space-time?
This is a null vector field that's pointing outward.
It's an outward radial null vector.
Right, an outward.
And your definition of the. I'm just wondering how this. Okay, so this is. The solution to this are null surface.
I'm not saying the solution to this is a null surface.
Yeah.
Because I'm saying that. That if we want, so in some sense, because we have the spherical symmetry, we're getting rid of the theta and phi.
Right.
So now essentially we have our two coordinates, say r in Vidya, it's r and v. But whatever two coordinates, and when I get down to here, I'm not assuming it's Vidya.
Okay.
So I'm saying that in that two-dimensional space, I have these outgoing this outgoing null vector.
Right.
But I'm choosing it's not. It's not actually the gradient of some scalar. I'm normalizing it so that when I contract this vector with the gradient of r, I get the same as a half the gradient of r contracted with the gradient of r.
Okay.
So I mean that's something that just it's something that if you go to the Vidya metric, it says that the n alpha is just v by dv in the Vidya metric. So in that case, it is just a derivative respective coordinate. Here, in some sense, you could say there's not a global coordinate that it's a derivative with respect to. In other words, along each null outgoing null line, there's a different v. But I'm choosing v to have this property that a derivative with respect to v along that particular null line is normalized in this form.
So you've normalized this outgoing null vector.
Right.
And now you're picking r. So that r cubed varies linearly in that direction, basically.
Right. So r cubed, I'm imagining that r cubed is a function of v, and so I'm choosing it for a v. There's a particular value of this r cubed, and I'm just saying I'm choosing it so that this second derivative of this vanishes.
And this has no relation to the apparent horizon.
Yeah, it's not the right. It's not where the apparent and it's.
Let's see. Does that depend on approximately where
is? So okay, let me give a little more of the solution for this.
Are you explaining why you chose the word the adjective adiabatic for this horizon?
Well, I chose it to be that it would follow where the event horizon would be if the evolution were adiabatic. That's how I chose the word.
Okay. There are other prescriptions that would also satisfy that definition. This is not the unique way of write down a quantity which tracks along the horizon in the adiabatic limit, right?
Right, right. No, this is not. And there's even two more of them I'll give. Maybe this is a little bit of a, I mean, it's just showing that there are some covariant ways to define some surfaces, and you can get surfaces, this surface, at least if it's a smooth adiabatic, it matches the horizon, the event horizon, much better than the apparent horizon does. So that's all. So it's the argument about the naked firewalls do not depend upon whether it's on one of these or another, but in some sense it's just showing that there do exist functions that if it were adiabatic and smooth have this right property.
Is it clear that it's time-like?
Well, it would be, it will be, Yeah, it will be time-like if the black hole is evaporating. I mean, if the mass is going down. Because, okay, so if I show this, it's equivalent to where the gradient vector of this dot product of two gradient vectors is in the outward null direction. So the gradient is null, and then and in particular it's outward rather than inward. So you get this equation. So I can have an actual equation for this, where this m dot means the m with respect to this v, which is normalized in the appropriate way. So basically, this shows that if the m dot is negative, then this is a little bit less than 1. So this 3 minus is a little bit bigger than 2. So this whole thing is then a little bit smaller than 2m. So this would be a little bit, you know, a little bit inside the thing. And so it does agree. It does agree to this expression. This order thing does differ, but of course this is an extremely tiny quantity. But I mean, at least to the order given, it agrees with that. It's not, if you wanted to follow this very near the end of the evaporation, you might run into trouble because this m dot 16 m dot might get more negative than minus 1, and then this gets complex. So if you really wanted to plot something. You know, Dong Hung Yan was plotting some of these things, and you know, he found, well, this thing disappeared at some stage. But that's very near the end, which is not too relevant here. But it's anyway. Then, okay. One disadvantage possibly of this is if I do have a fluctuation, this might sort of fluctuate, you know, at some short time interval, and that would mean this jumped around. So you might say if the evaporation is jumping around, maybe this isn't a good approximation for where the firewall would be. It would be a good approximation if there weren't any jumping around. If in other words, if the dm dt were minus alpha over m squared up to some point, and then you do a fluctuation, then this is perfectly fine. If you try to say after you have some fluctuation, because this jumps around, then this thing can jump around, and it may not. You know, it probably wouldn't be good for matching where the firewall would be after that. So I tried some other definitions. Now in this case, you have to know what this alpha is. I mean, the previous one, you didn't know that. All you have to do is know the space-time. But if you knew what the alpha was, then you can have this. And I just called it a fourth root horizon because I have fourth roots in it. The inverse of this is m is that. And that's also very close to where the event horizon would be if it were adiabatic. Another way to test this is to say, well, if the black hole, instead of evaporating at the rate where this quantity is a constant, suppose the event horizon were exactly at this point, and then you can go back and calculate this quantity in terms of this, in terms of epsilon, which is this small parameter. It's basically the evaporation rate. And then this function basically is 1 for when m is big, so it does match up very well. But then it decreases to this, and then it goes up to 2. But anyway, if you said the event horizon were exactly at this place, then you'd find that m dot would be approximately this, but it would the coefficient would deviate from 1 to getting a little bit less, and then go up to 2. Okay, so this is just another approximation. And again, the argument doesn't depend on any of these approximations, but it's just showing that there's different ways you can define things. One that I thought more recently is an even smoother approximation is to do some averaging over time, and I call this the smooth horizon. And basically, you look at the mass at previous time, so the y goes from 0 to infinity, and then you put in two exponentials, and basically this weights the thing. There's sort of a smoothing parameter a, and because of these two terms in there, it gives weighting such that effectively, if the m were changing linearly with this quantity, it basically gives you the extrapolation to what the mass would be at this future time. So in fact, that's a good one. It is evaporating smoothly. It's basically the size of the event horizon at one time is basically the same as the size that the apparent horizon would be at a time later by 1 over the surface gravity. So when it's evolving smoothly, when m dot is minus alpha over m squared, no matter what alpha is, you just take the apparent horizon at this time. That's not the size of the event horizon at this time. But then you look at the apparent horizon after it's shrunk, after time of 1 over the surface gravity, and that is that is what the event horizon would be at this time, to, you know, to very high accuracy, assuming that the rate is low. So in other words, during this time, it's hardly evaporated much. Okay, so this is another one. Of course, this one has an unknown smoothing parameter. You might say, well, if you chose it to be a log, which is big, it gives smoothing over roughly the scrambling time. And if this was very big, then it would do a lot of smoothing. Okay, I mean, these are a little bit of a side to the thing, but it's just some ways that you can give some approximations for where it is. And so now back to the main argument. I'm saying that if the firewall exists, it's close to where the event horizon would be if the black hole evolves smoothly and adiabatically according to this. You know, perhaps well estimated, maybe the smooth horizon is the best of these three that I've thought of for some suitable value of the smoothing parameter. However, the actual event horizon depends on the future evolution of the spacetime and not just that of the past. So quantum fluctuations in the future can lead the event horizon to deviate significantly from the smooth horizon or from whatever causal location that the firewall is at. So if the firewall is just determined by the past, whatever it is, then this quantum fluctuation is going to make the event horizon deviate. So if the mass lot rate exceeds the adiabatic formula, then this law, in other words, then the event horizon will be inside the smooth horizon. And so a firewall located at the smooth horizon would become naked, visible from future null infinity. Or if it's located however you define. Yes?
Okay, I'm just trying to understand the framework that you're okay. Using here. So normally, you know, people discuss evaporating black holes in a semi-classical framework where the metric is treated classically and the matter field is quantum mechanically, but it's coupled through the expectation value of the stress tensor.
Right, right.
So sort of by definition, these quantum fluctuations are already averaged and you're looking at the expected value of the stress tensor. So if you want to consider the effect of quantum fluctuations in the matter,
but you
want to do that, but then somehow keep the metric classical and want to see how the classical metric would respond to this. It just doesn't seem so consistent, right? If the matter quantum fluctuations are being considered, don't you have to sort of consider the metric as some quantum?
Well, I guess, in a sense, I'm doing it in such a crude way that I'm supposing instead of, I guess in some sense, in the quantum theory, you might say, well, you have wave functionals. I mean, one way in canonical formula is wave functionals over three geometries, for example. So I'm imagining that I do have some four geometry, but it's a whole, you know, it's a whole set of them. And in some sense, I'm taking the quantum theory and I'm imagining it gives different probabilities for different four geometries. So it's beyond semi-classical. I don't have a single four geometry, but it's not fully quantized because I don't really have wave functions for three geometries. I imagine that I have a bunch of sets. I mean, maybe they're decoring sets of four geometries. So I'm just imagining that if there was a fluctuation and the black hole emitted more for this time, then for that part of the quantum state, I mean, there's another part of the quantum state where it didn't do that, but the quantum state's a superposition, and in this one part where it did that, then the mass went down. So I'm sort of assuming that in each component of the quantum state, I have some sort of approximate
classical metric.
Yeah, approximate classical metric.
So you're taking superpositions of those, basically. I think that's the answer to Gary's question.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're doing something like taking superpositions of metrics that are...
So the full state would be some superposition of metrics where all these things are behaving differently.
Right, so it'd be something like that.
The effect of masses inside a given radius or whatever.
You know, I admit it's a little bit of cheat because, I mean, if you did the hydrogen atom, you don't do a superposition of paths of the electron. You do... So in some sense, you do a superposition of, well, if you did canonical quantum gravity, superposition of wave functionals of three geometry. So I am doing something crude where I'm imagining it's something like a superposition over four geometries. And then I'm just asking what each one does.
Normally, when you superpose, you're supposed to have the same eigenvalue of the Hamiltonian. I mean, okay, otherwise, what you superpose, I mean, here somehow you're superposing things which have different masses.
Well, but I'm including the radiation. So the total total mass is, well, of course, it doesn't have to be an energy eigenstate. It could be some superposition. But I'm saying that if you have extra radiation going out, then the part of the energy that's given by the black hole is now less. So I'm imagining a fluctuation in which you have more than average energy go into the radiation, and therefore less than average energy in the hole at that time. So it's right. It's the parts that don't conserve energy here. So okay. So all right. So then this okay. So from this equation, if we're back to the Vidya approximation, then you can write the mass in terms of R in this form. And so now let's actually just to find some forms of this, let's suppose that we divide the M into two parts and the R into two parts. So M1 and R part we're going to assume is the adiabatic part, or the part that's evolving smoothly. Did I write it here? Maybe I didn't. So M1 has this sort of behavior. And let's suppose that the fluctuation then gives us an M2 and R2 that's a small fluctuation of the thing. So then the total mass, I'll say, is the sum, and the radius is that. And then if you stick this in, that you can see that so the unperturbed mass loss rate. So the M1 is this, and you say such that you get that. And then quantum fluctuations then are small compared to the total mass and event horizon radius. So then you can write this. If you write this, okay, you get a quadratic term there, and then we will just, and then we will say that this piece is small, so we'll drop this times this, and then we be, so basically we have this, so we get the total mass, we get a formula, we linearized it in R2, in the fluctuation of the event horizon. So, and again, we're making the idealized assumption that even with quantum fluctuations, the metric remains spherically symmetrical and Vidya near the event horizon. But of course, the principle, obviously, you could have one part of the horizon might fluctuate, you know, it might be, and then one part of it fluctuation. So I don't think, it's just to make the math simpler, that I assume that it's all spherically symmetrical. I don't think the idea really changes. All right, so now let's pick some particular advance time, and let's suppose that the evolution was smooth up to that point. And so we ignore quantum fluctuations in the rate before that, so that up to that time, then this M2 is zero, that's the fluctuation. It's zero for that, and let's define the constant, the value of M at this time to be M1. And now we're assuming the black hole is very heavy in blank masses at that time, so this is very big, and we'll do it over a time that's much less than the evaporation time. So during this length of time, the fractional decay of the black hole over this advanced time is small, and the negative of the coefficient of this, it's M, but that's approximately, in this equation, this is R1, and that may be approximated to be M1, but it can be further approximated just this constant. So then, of course, now you get this equation for R2, this linear first-order equation in R2 that depends on how this M2 changes, and it's got constant coefficients, so therefore we can easily write down the solution of this. It has no exponentially growing departure of the event horizon from the unperturbed horizon. So then this is the deviation. And so we have this integral here, but we can, even if V is less than V naught, even if this is negative, there's a damped term there, but we still get a contribution even before the fluctuation turns on. In other words, we're going to turn this on at V naught and then see what effect it has on the. So let's, okay, here's a schematic diagram, which Donghun Yom, so I'm not responsible for. I'm not responsible for the fact he put my name in there, so. this idea is that, okay, that you have this smooth horizon here where you might think the event horizon was, but now you've got some fluctuation, and so actually the event horizon is over here, and here we had something that moved inward, but then the fluctuation could move the firewall, maybe it would be naked here, it's anywhere up here, you could see the firewall. Of course, then it might fluctuate, there'll be a fluctuation the other side, it might be inside the event horizon. So there could be part of it you don't see, part of it you see and part of it you don't see. And we assume that if firewall turned on basically at this time, the apparent horizon would be even further out here in this null diagram. It looks like it's moving in. Of course, the R difference here is comparable to there, for example. So it's not that the R difference is changing, but just in this, where that's 45, these are null lines, then it looks like this in the diagram. So, okay, that's a schematic diagram. It was just basically drawn by him. It's not actually using numerical solutions. Okay, since the adiabatic horizon gives this for M much bigger than 1 and V less than that, I mean, in other words, this rate doesn't change much over the time that we're considering it. let's consider a quantum fluctuation that's basically, we'll say it's f at t at v equals v naught. This is a Heaviside step function, so it gives zero for v less than v naught. So nothing happens before this v naught. Then after that, this turns on, and we assume that the rate, that this rate, it's the standard rate, but multiplied by a factor f, and then we'll put in something that it decays down, basically just to have some perturbation that has finite mass. So it has two constant. Hand off the edge, has two constant parameters, f for how large the quantum fluctuation, the energy emission rate relative is to the adiabatic rate. So if f were 1, you'd just be basically doubling the rate, and we'll assume that f is positive, so the quantum fluctuation increases the emission rate, and then beta for how fast the quantum fluctuation decays over advance time of 4 naught, which is the inverse of the surface gravity, or approximation of the surface gravity for the black hole. So if we put that in, then we can just integrate that. We say that M2 is 0 for that. Then the M2, of course, it starts off because M2 dot starts off there. Then of course, M2 starts off 0 at V equals V naught. These two terms cancel. But then as time goes on, this you basically just get this, you know, it has this sort of a curve. It just asymptotes. This goes to 0, and the mass changes by this amount. Then if you plug it back in to find the deviation in the event horizon, you find that there's two terms. there's this term with the Heaviside step function that applies for V less than that. So even before this becomes non-zero, you get a fluctuation in the event horizon. It's of course, if you go back to V, if V is less than that, then this quantity is negative. So it's of course, if you go back further, it's exponentially damped. It's exponentially very tiny until you approach this time. But then at V equals V naught, this is 1, and so the magnitude of it, the perturbation in the event horizon is just given by this. And then afterwards, it has this particular form. Eventually there is a shift. I mean, this shift in the thing because you did add a net amount of this particular fluctuation. Instead of having both a positive and negative part to it, it does increase the mass over what it would be before. From before, so the late time behavior is it did move the horizon in a bit. It decreased the mass more than what it would have been because it increased the mass emission rate. So, in other words, this implies the total mass fluctuation away from the adiabatic is this. If you see how much did the mass change, it got more negative than it would have been. And then the radial fluctuation in the event horizon radius at this time, and that's when it's the most negative, R2 is the most negative, is this, because M2 is negative, it's roughly that. So if the quantum fluctuation rate is very short, so that beta is much bigger than 1, then the shift in this would just be 2 times the mass, twice the total mass fluctuation. But if beta were smaller, then this would instead of being 2, it would be smaller. If beta was very tiny, it would be very tiny because you'd be taking a long time, and then this exponential damping. So anyway, so order of magnitude, you could say that it shifts by roughly the amount that the mass shifts. So the important point was that the reduction in the radius of the event horizon occurs. Well, it occurs even before V equals V naught. It's a maximum at V equals V naught for this particular form. And it occurs before there's any decrease in the mass below the adiabatic value. That's because the location of this teleological event horizon is defined by the future evolution of the space-time. It had to have adjusted in order to be right afterwards. So therefore, if the putative firewall occurs at a location determined purely causally by the past behavior of the space-time, and if it's sufficiently near where the event horizon would be under smooth adiabatic and evolution or emission thereafter, say near the smooth horizon, then these quantum fluctuations at a later advance times that reduce the mass below that given by the adiabatic evolution would move the actual event horizon inward, and even before the quantum fluctuations in the mass emission rate began, so that the event horizon becomes inside the location of the putative firewall. That is, the quantum fluctuations that increase the mass emission rate render such a firewall naked, visible to the external universe. So now a possible objection is that for alpha and beta and f of order unity, the inward shift is by a change of radius r2 of order 1 over m. And that means if you went to the frame of this firewall and you asked the proper distance to the horizon, it would be of the order of a Planck length. So you might say, well, the proper Pardon?
Much smaller than a Planck length.
Yeah, I suppose because of the alpha, I think. No, but I'm saying this is a change in the radius, but the proper distance is basically
the
square root of, I think, square root of 8m times the change in radius. So you multiply that by the m and take a square root, you get of order. You know, it's a bit smaller because of this alpha factor being less than 1. But it's, if I say alpha is of order 1, then it's of order, the Planck length. So now, if you said that you have an observer that went down there and then came back out, he'd have to have a proper acceleration of roughly the inverse of the distance from the horizon that he went, and so that would be of the order of the Planck acceleration, so that would give an unruh temperature of the order of the Planck temperature. So you might object that quantum gravity effects at such extreme acceleration would make a narrow firewall in practice indistinguishable from a firewall at or inside the event horizon. So that, now one possible answer to this, a couple of things. Well, in principle, F could be arbitrarily large, all of the probabilities would go down, in which case the firewall seems like it could be arbitrarily many Planck lengths outside, and an observer that reaches it but stays outside could have an acceleration and unruh temperature arbitrarily lower than the Planck value. So now I did a crude estimate of saying that, well, we emit roughly S particles of order, S particles, and so I might say that, well, we have this huge number of tries, and so, you know, each one, if I try to make it too big, it's exponentially damped, but then I made an estimate as to what the probability is for different sizes, a little more sophisticated than the, I don't have time to put it on here. And then basically I got that this change, that basically you could get the change in R could go as log S, the biggest one you'd see over the whole lifetime of the whole, and then you get a square root of that. So if you allowed an arbitrarily large black hole, then sometime during its evolution, then this naked naked firewall could be arbitrarily far outside the event horizon. Now, admittedly, because of the log into the 1/2, it's not too big even for the biggest. Well, I looked in Wikipedia and they had masses up to 30 billion and maybe one possible 40 billion, somewhat questionable. But if I put in that number, it turns out this is still, it's not very big. It's about 12 Planck units. Oh, I get a little better if I calculate the unruh temperature. I have to take the inverse of that and divide by 2 pi. So the unruh temperature is about 1/75 of a Planck unit. So you might say, well, maybe that's small enough that maybe in principle you could detect this or something without, I don't know. I mean, it is an issue with this that it's not overly big unless you have really gigantic black hole. If you had one much bigger, of course, you could make this arbitrarily big. So it's more of a question in principle. But then I suppose firewalls are questions of principle, probably, that probably nobody's going to dare jump. Well, we don't have any black holes that we know are sufficiently old. Anyway, I guess they're older than I am, but they're not as old as the page time. So. Anyway, now another idea was that Adam Brown suggested that maybe one might not wait for the firewall to become naked by a spontaneous quantum fluctuation, but you could disrobe it by black hole mining. So this would cause the event horizon to shrink much faster below the adiabatic horizon than would be very probable with spontaneous quantum emissions. So it seemed like with suitable mining, one could almost certainly make a firewall naked. Well, maybe I should retract a little bit of this because it might be related to discussions we were having about two-sided black holes. So I don't know. The details of this are work in progress. I'm not sure how to, it's not just a question of getting the mining rate fast, but to get the rate increase fast. And so I'm a little bit uncertain. I mean, one idea I thought of was to put masses on the end of strings and drop them into the black hole. And then the strings could carry out energy at much faster than the Hawking emission rate because they don't, the centrifugal barrier, you can get through the centrifugal barrier. But the trouble is to get the strings in, I have to have some masses, and that's going to increase the mass of the thing. And therefore, that's going to act in the opposite way. And the increase of the horizon there, you know, but by the time I start speeding up it's not clear whether we can get this to work, and I haven't thought of any really good ideas how, but it might be.
But I don't really understand what this is saying. I mean, even if you mine the black hole at the maximum possible rate, the black hole is still going to lose mass in a sense, adiabatically, slowly at small h-bar, or small Planck length. So why does this allow you to drive the horizon well inside what you would have thought of as the adiabatic horizon? I would have thought that to leading order the adiabatic parameter, it would still track the adiabatic horizon.
Yeah, well, I'm supposing that I could suddenly turn it on. I could turn on the mining very fast.
Yeah.
And so then I'm saying the event horizon, if I could turn it on without putting any positive mass in there at the beginning, which maybe is impossible, if I could turn it on suddenly, then I could say, well, that now the event horizon would have had to have adjusted before I did this.
And a non-adiabatic change.
So it'd be a non-adiabatic change in the thing. So I don't know. The details have got this to work, and I'm a bit worried that this process seems possibly similar enough to the thing we're talking about, the two-sided ones, that maybe the arguments against the two-sided ones would, against the mining thing. Let me just say this other issue that I've learned a lot from you people here. This slide, the first part I added after I got to Stanford, the second part I added this morning. So we hadn't thought about two-sided black holes until Leonard Susskind asked me about them, and he was about whether if you sent a shock in from one side, could it get out the other side? He was skeptical about that. But on the other hand, it seemed to me, until I met the experts here, that maybe that if a sufficiently weak shock ray were sent into an internal to the past two-sided black hole from the left CFT boundary, sending it in from this side, and then on the right side you change it from reflecting to absorbing boundary conditions, or so I was going to say maybe you couple that CFT to some other CFT, then the negative energy fluxing into the black hole arising during the resultant Hawking evaporation on the right would cause it to move inward across the weak shock wave, so the shock wave could traverse the wormhole and come out on the right. So anyway, I was in Stanford earlier, and Lenny and I had about 9 hours of discussion about this, and he was very skeptical, but he didn't have a strong argument against it. And then I came here, and well, several of you, but particularly I remember Don persuaded me that theorems by Aaron Wald establishing the generalized second law and the average null energy conditions and circumstances applicable to two-sided black holes that would rule out these traversable wormholes. And Don suggested to me that what negates this conjectured traversable wormhole is that when you change the boundary conditions from absorbing to from reflecting to absorbing, you wouldn't just immediately turn on negative energy flux going into there would also be some positive energy flux that would go in. So details of that would remain to be worked out, but I mean the theorems would suggest there must be something like that. And so then the idea is that this positive energy would move the horizon out perhaps more than the negative energy would move it in. So anyway, so I've become, convinced in the absence of further information but I don't think this is in some sense doing it sort of relying on quantum fluctuations. So I don't think this has any direct bearing on the one-sided black holes or the quantum fluctuations.
Well, What does Aaron assume about conditions on the expectation value of the stress tensor?
He doesn't assume them, he derives them.
He derives
them. He effectively, in this context, he looks at free quantum fields, and he just quantizes them on the null surface, or looks at their restriction to a null surface, the induced quantum theory, and proves that the average null energy condition holds. In this context, we have an achronal null GPC or something like that.
Okay. So he would agree that there is something that could be described as negative flux into the horizon. Is that right?
Oh, sure. The local flux can be negative. It's just that the average over the full generator has to be non-negative.
Okay.
And that's sufficient to show that you don't get reversibility.
Okay.
The positive fluctuations cause outward motion of the horizon more than the negative fluctuations cause inward motion.
Oh, sorry, the average has to be positive.
Right.
So if you have something that,
So local negative fluxes are certainly allowed.
But in particular, the Hawking situation can be described by having a negative flux going in. So the compensating positive flux you think of there is what?
So in Don's story, where you start off with basically reflecting walls, and initial equilibrium.
Yeah.
So from past infinity up to some finite time, you
it's
have by definition no flux.
Yeah.
But later time, you clearly have negative flux.
Yeah.
But the theorem says the integral has to be non-negative.
Non-negative.
So there must be a, and it turns out it's a certain integral. We think of it as the energy flux that's negative at finite times is at a finite rate. That's energy defined by killing time. The energy relevant here is the energy contracted with the affine parameter. So that's like, it's like the killing energy where you throw in a factor where you exponentially damp everything in the far future.
Mm-hmm.
So that integral is not naively infinite, it's just a little bit because it's an exponential convergence factor.
Mm-hmm.
So the theorem says that there's some compensating blob which is about a Hawking quantum worth of positive energy flux that falls in somewhere, and it can only happen at the transition. So that's the theorem.
Yeah, and because of this damping factor, I guess that means even though you know, naively you might say, well, there's a very large amount of negative energy that goes in, but because of the damping factor, you really only need to have a tiny positive energy or order of thermal rate, of thermal quantum or something.
The physical point is that energy fluxes earlier across the horizon give more shift in the horizon,
more
the fact that it's more
right.
unstable. So you just need a small positive fluctuation early enough that you're safe.
Yeah, yeah.
Which, and it does raise the question of, I mean, it's all related to things like the fact that fluctuations in vacuum energy at different places are not independent, but there are correlations. And so that fact is something that has not been taken into account in your analysis of the one-sided black hole case. And I have no real problem with your predictions, and they don't bother me all that much. It's an interesting question whether taking into account those correlations might reduce your effect even further beyond your root log S level.
Okay, if you took, so you're saying that.
I don't know, it's something that one can think about, but that's the possible connection.
Right, right.
Correlation, we know correlations are important for vacuum fluctuations.
Right, right. Yeah, yeah, okay, well that would be, okay, well I'm pretty much end here, but in conclusion, it seems that if putative firewalls are locations determined by the past structure of the space-time to be near where the event horizon would be if the black hole evolved adiabatically in the future, then and quantum fluctuation, the emission rate can render them naked. Now, how naked is maybe up for. So if the firewall, it's not hidden inside the region with Planckian local temperature, at least if it can be, and its presence would, well, it would at least it would be odd with the feeling that. General relativity and usual quantum field theory, which would not sort of predict something there. So anyway, so I guess we might say that more specifically being at the exterior of the event horizon means the firewall could potentially influence the exterior space-time. Of course, without a model of what the firewall does, we can't say, but it seems somewhat dangerous that it might do something. So even observers that do not fall in the black hole could have a fiery experience. And, it could, in principle, affect the spectrum of the Hawking radiation, which means that the presence of a firewall could be inferred even by asymptotic observers, I mean, if it does have an effect. And so such an ancient firewall, a firewall far outside the event horizon, is therefore problematic, and giving up the no-drama assumption no longer seems like a palatable, most conservative option. And then I'll just give our acknowledgments. But. So I should get AMP's response to this.
Mm-hmm.
Or how would you say, what does it? Do you think it makes them less conservative, or what's the?
I think we certainly expected, I'm not surprised by the results.
Okay.
It's consistent with the behavior that I thought we were talking about. So it doesn't make them any less conservative in my book. If it makes it less conservative for others, that's fine. I think that merely is a commentary on how we perceive other resolutions as failing to be conservative.
Yes, okay.
It's a relative statement. But the statement that we found it to be most conservative was an opinion. It's not something you can sit here and argue logically about.
I guess this is going a little bit off, but I guess the thing that I never completely understood is it seems to be almost certain that quantum gravity is, non-local and you don't have local field theory precisely anywhere. But I don't know, I've never quite understood. I always feel a little nervous about an argument that makes an assumption that's approximately good, but it's not exactly good. But how much can you trust the conclusions if this one assumption is only an approximation? But I don't know whether you have any comments on on that? I mean, in other words, it just seemed to me when I looked at the assumptions, I just give up the effective field theory, and then at least at the formal mathematical level, you don't. There's no argument that you have to have a firewall. But
it's an interesting. I mean, if you're going to do that, you need to give up effective field theory at some substantial level. Some substantial level. I mean, it's not
okay.
It's an interesting question. If you could quantify, in some way, you know, how, you know, put a metric on the set of deviations from effective field theory, and then quantify how big they must be to resolve the problem, and that has not been done.
But, or to resolve which problem? The original problem, or
any version of the problem?
You mean the original information problem?
I'm never clear what you mean by the original information problem, but
that problem.
That problem. Yes. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's one sort of measure of the nature of these different kinds of resolutions, and again, that's how hard the departure is. You know, hard in the technical sense.
There are many measures.
Hard versus soft.
Sure. Yes. Okay. Great.
Right.
Right. Okay.
Okay, so I certainly can't claim to resolve the puzzle. I'm just trying to amass a little more evidence against firewalls, but maybe my main thing is, okay, I'm sort of skeptical about the local quantum field theory assumption, but is it fair to say
violated this badly? Is that, you know, that's,
but, well, let me phrase it in a way that you like, you know. What's your opinion about whether, if you had a truly old black hole older than page time, you would expect the violations of local quantum field theory to be large enough that if two of those black holes collided, you would see an effect of it on a LIGO signal?
Well, that's an important question.
It's an important question. Okay.
As we discussed last week.
Yeah.
So is there? Yeah. I mean, okay. I don't know how to.
Would you be?
Well, the problem is if you don't have any model for this, I mean, you know, then you can ask, and you can get any claim all the way from, like, you know, observable stuff all the way to, like, you know, to nothing will happen. I mean, you know, essentially, unless you build a model for what's happening there, for the fundamental theory. And I mean, the only thing which is not right now is that, you know, in string theory, you can build supersymmetric and extremal black holes. Those you can model, and then you can build a structure at the horizon. You can get, you know, you can really build, you know, the flesh and bone structure. You can ask questions like, you know, what's happening if I spin it, for example, does it spin in a certain way? I mean, there you can actually ask these kind of questions. If you don't build such a structure, asking such questions is quite premature. I mean, you can get answers all the way from nothing to, like, you know, big LIGO signal 10 times bigger. I mean, you know, essentially, unless you have the structure to make calculations, there's nothing you can do.
Well, again, there is something you can do. You can start parameterizing your ignorance, the time-honored tradition in physics. Right, and try to think about how your sensitivity depends on those parameters.
But the problem is, essentially, whatever structure you have there, I mean, if whatever structure forms a firewall obeys, you know, some obvious energy conditions, I mean, okay, it has to be Planck size, but, you know, because it's at the horizon, it has to fall in, it has to go at the speed of light. Essentially, you cannot put normal stuff there. I mean, you have
stuff there which doesn't obey,
you know, usual energy conditions. If you put massless particles going along the horizon, they'll dilute in a crossing time, and they're done. If you put massive stuff, you know, it goes along the horizon at with the speed of light, it has infinite energy, it back reacts to hell, there's no more black hole. So essentially, the ingredients you have to put there are completely different from whatever, you know, usual stuff you put.
I mean,
if it's a few Planck lengths, you know, it's, you know, 40 Planck lengths away, it still needs to have an incredibly huge back reaction. You know, if you just look, you know, if you try to build something.
But in the idealized limit that it was in the classical GR and you had an infinitely thin shell, couldn't you? You could presumably have it exactly at the event horizon and it wouldn't produce any back reaction, would it? Because you've got an infinite.
It would fall in. Somebody has to keep it there, right? It cannot just stay there. It falls in.
In Don's model, it's an outgoing null shell. It propagates along the event horizon.
But it propagates with the speed of light. I mean,
but
then it has a huge back reaction, and then, you know, it's basically gone. I mean, then it just, you know, completely back reacts in a geometry, and you don't trust anything.
That's also true.
So, you know, whatever you build, you know, if you build it there, you know, it backreacts and it just messes up the whole.
But it doesn't. Is that right? I mean, the outside could be exactly Schwarzschild if it was exactly. I guess let's see. The inside would it? If it had a finite shell, what would happen? Would the mass would jump, so you'd be
principal mass you put in the shell.
Well, the mass is infinite. I mean, the mass is...
Well, no. I mean, as seen from infinity, it could be finite. It's just the mass energy is seen locally.
But it would just backreact to hell. I mean, it would just backreact into something completely weird, which doesn't have any black hole interpretation, any horizon, or any, you know.
But the spirit of this is good, and what you're saying, namely, you know, if you believe that the answer is a firewall, you need to start parameterizing and describing the physics, you know, modeling of the physics that of those firewalls, and giving a model for how they evolve, say, if there are fluctuations, et cetera.
This is a great conversation to keep having for the relevant parties. are there any more questions for Don? All right, if not, we should thank him again.